Chapter 10. So inspiring, as much perhaps by its vague suggestion of danger, as by the hopes of success it never fails to awaken in the heart of a true adventurer. And its immutable aspect of profound and still repose, seen thus under streams of fire, and in the midst of a violent uproar, made it appear inconceivably mysterious and amazing. Between the squalls there were short moments of calm, while now and then even the thunder would cease, as if to draw breath. During one of those intervals, lingered, tired and sleepy, was beginning to doze where he stood, when suddenly it occurred to him that, somewhere below, the sea had spoken in a human voice. It had said, "Praise be to God," and the voice sounded small, clear, and confident, like the voice of a child speaking in a cathedral. Lingard gave a start and thought, "I've dreamed this," and directly the sea said very close to him, "Give a rope." The thunder growled wickedly, and Lingard, after shouting to the men on deck, peered down at the water, until at last he made out floating close alongside the upturned face of a man with staring eyes that gleamed at him, and then blinked quickly to a flash of lightning. By that time all hands in the brig were wildly active, and many ropes' ends had been thrown over. Then together with a gust of wind, and, as if blown on board, a man tumbled over the rail, and fell all in a heap upon the deck. Before anyone had the time to pick him up, he leaped to his feet, causing the people around him to step back hurriedly. A sinister blue glare showed the bewildered faces, and the petrified attitudes of men completely deafened by the accompanying peal of thunder. After a time, as if two beings plunged in the abyss of eternal silence, there came to their ears an unfamiliar thin, faraway voice saying, "I seek the white man." "Here," cried Lingard. Then, when he had the stranger, dripping and naked, but for a soaked waistcloth, under the lamp of the cabin, he said, "I don't know you. My name is Jaffer, and I come from Potahassam, who is my chief and dear friend. Do you know this?" He held up a thick gold ring, set with a fairly good emerald. "I have seen it before on the Raja's finger," said Lingard, looking very grave. "It is the witness of the truth I speak. The message from Assam is depart and forget." "Apostrophe, I don't forget," said Lingard, slowly. I am not that kind of man. What folly is this?" It is unnecessary to give at full length the story told by Jaffer. It appears that on his return home, after the meeting with Lingard, Assam found his relative dying, and a strong party formed to oppose his rightful successor. The old Rajatullah died late at night, and as Jaffer put it, before the sun rose there were already blows exchanged in the courtyard of the ruler's dalam. This was the preliminary fight of a civil war, fostered by foreign intrigues. A war of jungle and river, of assaulted stockades and forest ambushes. In this contest, both parties according to Jaffer displayed great courage, and one of them an unswerving devotion to what, almost from the first, was a lost cause. Before a month elapsed, Assam, though still chief of an armed band, was already a fugitive. He kept up the struggle, however, with some vague notion that Lingard's arrival would turn the tide. "For weeks we lived on wild rice. For days we fought with nothing but water in our bellies," declaimed Jaffer in the tone of a true fire-eater. And then he went on to relate how, driven steadily down to the sea, Assam, with a small band of followers, had been for days holding the stockade by the waterside. "But every night some men disappeared," confessed Jaffer. "They were weary and hungry and they went to eat with their enemies. We are only 10 now, 10 men, and a woman with the heart of a man, who are tonight starving, and tomorrow shall die swiftly. We saw your ship afar all day, but you have come too late. And for fear of treachery and lest harm should befall you, his friend the Raja gave me the ring and I crept on my stomach over the sand, and I swam in the night and I, Jaffer, the best swimmer in Wajo, and the slave of Assam, tell you his message to you is depart, and forget, and this is his gift take." He caught hold suddenly of Lingard's hand, thrust roughly into its ring, and then for the first time looked round the cabin with wondering but fearless eyes. They lingered over the semicircle of bayonets, and rested fondly on musket racks. He grunted in admiration. "Yewa, this is strength," he murmured as if to himself. "But it has come too late." "Perhaps not," cried Lingard. "Too late," said Jaffer. "We are 10 only, and at sunrise we go out to die." He went to the cabin door, and hesitated there with a puzzled air, being unused to locks and door handles. "What are you going to do?" asked Lingard. "I shall swim back," replied Jaffer. "See, the message is spoken, and the night cannot last forever." "You can stop with me," said Lingard, looking at the man searchingly. "Hassam waits," was the curt answer. "Did he tell you to return?" asked Lingard. "No. What need?" said the other in a surprised tone. Lingard seized his hand impulsively. "If I had 10 men like you," he cried. "We are 10, but they are 20 to 1, said Jaffer, simply. Lingard opened the door. "Do you want anything that a man can give?" he asked. The Malay had a moment of hesitation, and Lingard noticed the sunken eyes, the prominent ribs, and the worn-out look of the man. "Speak out," he urged with a smile. "The bearer of a gift must have a reward." "A drink of water and a handful of rice for strength to reach the shore," said Jaffer sturdily. "F4 over there," he tossed his head, "he had nothing to eat today." "You shall have it, give it to you with my own hands," muttered Lingard. He did so, and thus lowered himself in Jaffer's estimation for a time. While the messenger, squatting on the floor, ate without haste, but with considerable earnestness, Lingard thought out a plan of action. In his ignorance as to the true state of affairs in the country, to save Hassam from the immediate danger of his position was all that he could reasonably attempt. To that end, Lingard proposed to swing out his longboat and send her close inshore to take off Hassam and his men. He knew enough of Malays to feel sure that on such a night the besiegers, now certain of success, and being, Jaffer said, in possession of everything that could float, would not be very vigilant, especially on the seafront of the stockade. The very fact of Jaffer having managed to swim off undetected proved that much. The brig's boat could, when the frequency of lightning abated, approach unseen close to the beach, and the defeated party, either stealing out one by one, or making a rush in a body, would embark and be received in the brig. This plan was explained to Jaffer, who heard it without the slightest mark of interest, being apparently too busy eating. When the last grain of rice was gone, he stood up, took a long pull at the water bottle, muttered, "Colon, I hear. Good. I will tell Hassam," and tightening the rag round his loins, prepared to go. "Give me time to swim ashore," he said, "and when the boat starts, put another light beside the one that burns now like a star above your vessel. We shall see and understand. And don't send the boat till there is less lightning. A boat is bigger than a man in the water. Tell the rowers to pull for the palm grove and cease when an oar, thrust down with a strong arm, touches the bottom. Very soon they will hear our hail, but if no one comes they must go away before daylight. A chief may prefer death to life, and we who are left are all of true heart. Do you understand, oh big man?" "The chap has plenty of sense," muttered Lingard to himself, and when they stood side by side on the deck, he said, "But there may be enemies on the beach, oh Jaffer, and they also may shout to deceive my men. So let your hail be lightning. Will you remember?" For a time Jaffer seemed to be choking. "Lightning. Is that right? I say, is that right, oh strong man?" Next moment he appeared upright and shadowy on the rail. "Yes. That's right. Go now," said Lingard, and Jaffer leaped off, becoming invisible long before he struck the water. Then there was a splash. After a while a spluttering voice cried faintly, "Lightning. Ah, ha." And suddenly the next thunder squall burst upon the coast. and the crashing flares of light lingered, and again the quick vision of a white beach, the inclined palm trees of the grove, the stockade by the sea, the forest far away. A vast landscape, mysterious and still, Asim's native country sleeping unmoved under the wrath and fire of heaven. IV, a traveler visiting Weizhou today may, if he deserves the confidence of the common people, hear the traditional account of the last civil war, together with the legend of a chief and his sister, whose mother had been a great princess suspected of sorcery, and on her deathbed had communicated to these two the secrets of the art of magic. The chief's sister especially, with the aspect of a child, and the fearlessness of a great fighter, became skilled in casting spells. They were defeated by the son of their uncle, because will explain the narrator simply the courage of us Weizhou people is so great, that magic can do nothing against it. I fought in that war. We had them with their backs to the sea. And then he will go on to relate in an odd tone, how on a certain night, and there was such a thunderstorm as has been never heard of before since a ship, resembling the ships of white men, appeared off the coast, as though as he had sailed down from the clouds. She moved, he will affirm, with her sails bellying against the wind. In size she was like an island. The lightning played between her masts which were as high as the summits of mountains. A star burned low through the clouds above her. We knew it for a star at once, because no flame of man's kindling could have endured the wind and rain of that night. It was such a night, that we on the watch hardly dared look upon the sea. The heavy rain was beating down our eyelids. And when day came, the ship was nowhere to be seen, and in the stockade, where the day before there were 100 or more at our mercy, there was no one. The chief, Asim, was gone, and the lady who was a princess in the country, and nobody knows what became of them from that day to this. Sometimes traders from our parts talk of having heard of them here, and heard of them there, but these are the lies of men who go afar for gain. We who live in the country believe that the ship sailed back into the clouds, whence the lady's magic made her come. Did we not see the ship with our own eyes? And as to Raja Asim and his sister, Mazamata, some men say one thing and some another, but God alone knows the truth. Such is the traditional account of Lingard's visit to the shores of Boni. And the truth is he came and went the same night. For, when the dawn broke on a cloudy sky, the brig, under reefed canvas and smothered in sprays, was storming along to the southward on her way out of the gulf. Lingard, watching over the rapid course of his vessel, looked ahead with anxious eyes and more than once asked himself with wonder, why, after all, was he thus pressing her under all the sail she could carry? His hair was blown about by the wind, his mind was full of care, and the indistinct shapes of many new thoughts, and under his feet, the obedient brig dashed headlong from wave to wave. Her owner and commander did not know where he was going. That adventurer had only a confused notion of being on the threshold of a big adventure. There was something to be done, and he felt he would have to do it. It was expected of him. The seas expected it. The land expected it. Men also. The story of war and of suffering, Jaffer's display of fidelity, the sight of Asim and his sister, the night, the tempest, the coast under streams of fire, all this made one inspiring manifestation of a life calling to him distinctly for interference. But what appealed to him most was the silent, the complete, unquestioning, and apparently uncurious, trust of these people. They came away from death straight into his arms as it were, and remained in them passive, as though there had been no such thing as doubt, or hope or desire. This amazing unconcern seemed to put him under a heavy load of obligation. He argued to himself that had not these defeated men expected everything from him, they could not have been so indifferent to his action. Their dumb quietude stirred him more than the most ardent pleading. Not a word, not a whisper, not a questioning look even. They did not ask. It flattered him. He was also rather glad of it, because if the unconscious part of him was perfectly certain of its action, he, himself, did not know what to do with those bruised and battered beings a playful fate had delivered suddenly into his hands. He had received the fugitives personally, had helped some over the rail. In the darkness, slashed about by lightning, he had guessed that not one of them was unwounded, and in the midst of tottering shapes he wondered how on earth they had managed to reach the longboat that had brought them off. He caught unceremoniously in his arms the smallest of these shapes, and carried it into the cabin, then without looking at his light burden ran up again on deck, to get the brig underway. While shouting out orders, he was dimly aware of someone hovering near his elbow. It was Asim. "I am not ready for war," he explained, rapidly, over his shoulder, "and tomorrow there may be no wind." Afterward, for a time, he forgot everybody and everything, while he conned the brig through the few outlying dangers. But in half an hour, and running off with the wind on the quarter, he was quite clear of the coast and breathed freely. It was only then that he approached two others on that poop, where he was accustomed in moments of difficulty to commune alone with his craft. Asim had called his sister out of the cabin. Now and then Lingard could see them with fierce distinctness, side by side, and with twined arms, looking toward the mysterious country that seemed at every flash to leap away farther from the brig unscathed and fading. The thought uppermost in Lingard's mind was, "Colin, what on earth am I going to do with them?" And no one seemed to care what he would do. Jaffer, with eight others quartered on the main hatch, looked at each other's wounds and conversed interminably in low tones. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.